14, take on 3 guys at the same time and give them all their money's worth. Fell off a ship once, 5 miles out to sea. Swam 5 miles with my life passing before me with every stroke. Once I shook hands with President Truman in the lobby of the Hotel Muehlenbach. Harry S. Truman. When I was working for the hospital, driving an ambulance, I saw every side of life there is. Things that would make a dog vomit. But Andy, he didn't know one dumb, damn, darn thing except what he'd read in books. He was innocent as a little child. Some kid with a box of Cracker Jack. He'd never once been with a woman. Man or mule. He said so himself. Maybe that's what I liked about him most. How he wouldn't prevaricate. The rest of us on the row, we're all a bunch of bull artists. I'm one of the worst. Shoot, you've got to talk about something. Brag. Otherwise you're nobody. Nothing. A potato vegetating in your 7x10 limbo. But Andy never would partake. He said, what's the use telling a lot of stuff that never happened? Old Perry, though. He wasn't sorry to see the last of Andy. Andy was the one thing in the world Perry wants to be. Educated. And Perry couldn't forgive him for it. You know how Perry's always using $100 words he doesn't half know the meaning of? Sounds like one of them college niggers. Boy, it burned his bottom to have Andy catch up on him and haul him to the curb. Of course, Andy was just trying to give him what he wanted. An education. The truth is, can't anybody get along with Perry? He hasn't got a single friend on the premises. I mean, just who the hell does he think he is? Sneering at everybody. Calling people perverts and degenerates. Going on about what low IQs they have. It's too bad we can't all be such sensitive souls like little Perry. Saints. Boy, but I know some hard rocks who'd gladly go to the corner if they could get him alone in the shower room for just one hot minute. The way he hi-hats York and Latham. Ronnie says he sure wishes he knew where he could lay hold of a bullwhip. Says he'd like to squeeze Perry a little. I don't blame him. After all, we're all in the same fix, and they're pretty good boys. Hickok chuckled ruefully, shrugged, and said, you know what I mean. Good, considering. Ronnie York's mother has been here to visit him several times. One day, out in the waiting room, she met my mother, and now they've come to be each other's number one buddy. Mrs. York wants my mother to come visit her home in Florida, maybe even live there. Jesus, I wish she would. Then she wouldn't have to go through this ordeal. Once a month, riding the bus here to see me. Smiling. Trying to find something to say. Make me feel good. The poor lady. I don't know how she stands it. I wonder she isn't crazy. Hickok's uneven eyes turned toward a window in the visiting room. His face, puffy, pallid as a funeral lily, gleamed in the weak winter sunshine filtering through the bar-shrouded glass. The poor lady. She wrote the warden and asked him if she could speak to Perry the next time she came here. She wanted to hear from Perry himself how he killed those people, how I never fired shot one. All I can hope is that someday we'll get a new trial and Perry will testify and tell the truth. Only I doubt it. He's plain determined that if he goes, I go. Back to back. It's not right. Many a man has killed and never seen the inside of a death cell. And I never killed anybody. If you've got $50,000 to spend, you could bump off half of Kansas City and just laugh, ha ha. A sudden grin obliterated his woeful indignation. Uh-oh. There I go again. Old crybaby. You'd think I'd learn. But honest to God, I've done my damnedest to get along with Perry. Only he's so critical. Two-faced. So jealous of every little thing. Every letter I get. Every visit. Nobody ever comes to see him except you, he said, nodding at the journalist, who was as equally well acquainted with Smith as he was with Hickok. Or his lawyer. Remember when he was in the hospital? With that phony starvation routine? And his dad sent the postcard? Well, the warden wrote Perry's dad and said he was welcome to come here anytime. But he never has showed up. I don't know. Sometimes you got to feel sorry for Perry. He must be one of the most alone people there ever was. But, oh, the hell with him. It's mostly every bit his own fault. Hickok slipped another cigarette away from a package of Pall Malls, wrinkled his nose, and said, I've tried to quit smoking. Then I figure what difference does it make under the circumstances? With a little luck, maybe I'll get cancer and beat the state at its own game. For a while there, I was smoking cigars. Andy's. The morning after they hanged him, I woke up and called to him, Andy, the way I usually did. Then I remembered he was on his way to Missouri, with the aunt and uncle. I looked out in the corridor. His cell had been cleaned out, and all his junk was piled there. The mattress off his bunk, his slippers, and the scrapbook with all the food pictures. He called it his icebox. And this box of Macbeth cigars. I told the guard Andy wanted me to have them, left them to me in his will. Actually, I never smoked them all. Maybe it was the idea of Andy, but somehow they gave me indigestion. Well, what's there to say about capital punishment? I'm not against it. Revenge is all it is, but what's wrong with revenge? It's very important. If I was kin to the Clutters, or any of the parties York and Latham dispensed with, I couldn't rest in peace till the ones responsible had taken that ride on the big swing. These people that write letters to the newspapers. There were two in a Topeka paper the other day, one from a minister, saying, in effect, what is all this legal farce? Why haven't those sons of bitches Smith and Hickok got it in the neck? How come those murdering sons of bitches are still eating up the taxpayers' money? Well, I can see their side. They're mad because they're not getting what they want. Revenge. And they're not going to get it if I can help it. I believe in hanging. Just so long as I'm not the one being hanged. But then, he was. Another 3 years passed, and during those years, two exceptionally skillful Kansas City lawyers, Joseph P. Jenkins and Robert Bingham, replaced Schultz, the latter having resigned from the case. Appointed by a federal judge and working without compensation, but motivated by a hard-held opinion that the defendants had been the victims of a nightmarishly unfair trial, Jenkins and Bingham filed numerous appeals within the framework of the federal court system, thereby avoiding three execution dates, October 25, 1962, August 8, 1963, and February 18, 1965. The attorneys contended that their clients had been unjustly convicted because legal counsel had not been appointed them until after they had confessed and had waived preliminary hearings, and because they were not competently represented at their trial, were convicted with the help of evidence seized without a search warrant. The shotgun and knife taken from the Hickok home were not granted a change of venue, even though the environs of the trial had been saturated with publicity prejudicial to the accused. With these arguments, Jenkins and Bingham succeeded in carrying the case three times to the United States Supreme Court, the big boy, as many litigating prisoners refer to it. But on each occasion, the court, which never comments on its decisions in such instances, denied the appeals by refusing to grant the writs of certiorari that would have entitled the appellants to a full hearing before the court. In March 1965, after Smith and Hickok had been confined in their death row cells almost 2,000 days, the Kansas Supreme Court decreed that their lives must end between midnight and 2 a.m., Wednesday, April 14th, 1965. Subsequently, a clemency appeal was presented to the newly elected governor of Kansas, William Avery. But Avery, a rich farmer sensitive to public opinion, refused to intervene, a decision he felt to be in the best interest of the people of Kansas. 2 months later, Avery also denied the clemency appeals of York and Latham, who were hanged on June 22, 1965. And so it happened that in the daylight hours of that Wednesday morning, Alvin Dewey, breakfasting in the coffee shop of a Topeka hotel, read, on the first page of the Kansas City Star, a headline he had long awaited: Die on Rope for Bloody Crime. The story, written by an Associated Press reporter, began, Richard Eugene Hickok and Perry Edward Smith, partners in crime, died on the gallows at the state prison early today for one of the bloodiest murders in Kansas criminal annals. Hickok, 33 years old, died first at 12:41 a.m. Smith, 36, died at 1:19. Dewey had watched them die, for he had been among the 20-odd witnesses invited to the ceremony. He had never attended an execution, and when, on the midnight past, he entered the cold warehouse, the scenery had surprised him. He had anticipated a setting of suitable dignity, not this bleakly lighted cavern cluttered with lumber and other debris. But the gallows itself, with its two pale nooses attached to a crossbeam, was imposing enough. And so, in an unexpected style, was the hangman, who cast a long shadow from his perch on the platform at the top of the wooden instrument's 13 steps. The hangman, an anonymous, leathery gentleman who had been imported from Missouri for the event, for which he was paid $600, was attired in an aged, double-breasted, pin-striped suit, overly commodious for the narrow figure inside it. The coat came nearly to his knees, and on his head he wore a cowboy hat which, when first bought, had perhaps been bright green, but was now a weathered, sweat-stained oddity. Also, Dewey found the self-consciously casual conversation of his fellow witnesses, as they stood awaiting the start of what one witness termed the festivities, disconcerting.
What I heard was, they was going to let them draw straws to see who dropped first, or flip a coin. But Smith says why not do it alphabetically? Guess 'cause S comes after H. Ha!
Read in the paper, afternoon paper, what they ordered for their last meal?
Ordered the same menu.
Shrimp, French fries, garlic bread, ice cream and strawberries and whipped cream. Understand Smith didn't touch his much. That Hickok's got a sense of humor. They was telling me how, about an hour ago, one of the guards says to him, This must be the longest night of your life. And Hickok, he laughs and says, No, the shortest.
Did you hear about Hickok's eyes? He left them to an eye doctor. Soon as they cut him down, this doctor's gonna yank out his eyes and stick them in somebody else's head.
Can't say I'd want to be that somebody. I'd feel peculiar with them eyes in my head.
Christ! Is that rain? All the windows down. My new Chevy. Christ!
The sudden rain wrapped the high warehouse roof. The sound, not unlike the rat-a-tat-tat of parade drums, heralded Hickok's arrival. Accompanied by six guards and a prayer-murmuring chaplain, he entered the death place handcuffed and wearing an ugly harness of leather straps that bound his arms to his torso. At the foot of the gallows, the warden read to him the official order of execution, a two-page document, and as the warden read, Hickok's eyes, enfeebled by half a decade of cell shadows, roamed the little audience until, not seeing what he sought, he asked the nearest guard in a whisper if any member of the Clutter family was present. When he was told no, the prisoner seemed disappointed,
as though he thought the protocol surrounding this ritual of vengeance was not being properly observed. As is customary, the warden, having finished his recitation, asked the condemned man whether he had any last statement to make. Hickok nodded. "I just want to say I hold no hard feelings. You people are sending me to a better world than this ever was." Then, as if to emphasize the point, he shook hands with the four men mainly responsible for his capture and conviction, all of whom had requested permission to attend the executions. KBI agents Roy Church, Clarence Dunce, Harold Nye, and Dewey himself. "Nice to see you," Hickok said with his most charming smile. It was as if he were greeting guests at his own funeral. The hangman coughed, impatiently lifted his cowboy hat and settled it again, a gesture somehow reminiscent of a turkey buzzard huffing, then smoothing its neck feathers. And Hickok, nudged by an attendant, mounted the scaffold steps. "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Blessed is the name of the Lord," the chaplain intoned as the rain's sound accelerated, as the noose was fitted, and as a delicate black mask was tied round the prisoner's eyes. "May the Lord have mercy on your soul." The trap door opened, and Hickok hung for all to see a full 20 minutes before the prison doctor at last said, "I pronounce this man dead." A hearse, its blazing headlights beaded with rain, drove into the warehouse, and the body, placed on a litter and shrouded under a blanket, was carried to the hearse and out into the night. Staring after it, Roy Church shook his head. "I never would have believed he had the guts to take it like he did. I had him tagged a coward." The man to whom he spoke, another detective, said, "Aw, Roy, the guy was a punk. A mean bastard. He deserved it." Church, with thoughtful eyes, continued to shake his head. While waiting for the second execution, a reporter and a guard conversed. The reporter said, "This your first hanging?" "I seen Lee Andrews." "This here's my first." "Yeah? How'd you like it?" The reporter pursed his lips. "Nobody in our office wanted the assignment." "Me either. But it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. Just like jumping off a diving board. Only with a rope around your neck. They don't feel nothing. Drop, snap, and that's it. They don't feel nothing." "Are you sure?" "I was standing right close. I could hear him gasping for breath." "Uh-huh, but he don't feel nothing. Wouldn't be humane if he did." "Well, and I suppose they feed them a lot of pills. Sedatives?" "Hell no. Against the rules. Here comes Smith." "Gosh, I didn't know he was such a shrimp." "Yeah, he's little. But so is a tarantula." As he was brought into the warehouse, Smith recognized his old foe, Dewey. He stopped chewing a hunk of double mint gum he had in his mouth and grinned and winked at Dewey, jaunty and mischievous. But after the warden asked if he had anything to say, his expression was sober. His sensitive eyes gazed gravely at the surrounding faces, swerved up to the shadowy hangman, then downward to his own manacled hands. He looked at his fingers, which were stained with ink and paint, for he'd spent his final 3 years on death row painting self-portraits and pictures of children, usually the children of inmates who supplied him with photographs of their seldom-seen progeny. "I think," he said, "it's a hell of a thing to take a life in this manner. I don't believe in capital punishment, morally or legally. Maybe I had something to contribute. Something..." His assurance faltered. Shyness blurred his voice, lowered it to a just audible level. "It would be meaningless to apologize for what I did. Even inappropriate. But I do. I apologize." Steps, noose, mask. But before the mask was adjusted, The prisoner spat his chewing gum into the chaplain's outstretched palm. Dewey shut his eyes. He kept them shut until he heard the thud snap that announces a rope-broken neck. Like the majority of American law enforcement officials, Dewey is certain that capital punishment is a deterrent to violent crime, and he felt that if ever the penalty had been earned, the present instance was it. The preceding execution had not disturbed him. He had never had much use for Hickok, who seemed to him a small-time chiseler who got out of his depth, empty and worthless. But Smith, though he was the true murderer, aroused another response. For Perry possessed a quality, the aura of an exiled animal, a creature walking wounded that the detective could not disregard. He remembered his first meeting with Perry in the interrogation room at police headquarters in Las Vegas. The dwarfish boy man seated in the metal chair, his small booted feet not quite brushing the floor. And when Dewey now opened his eyes, that is what he saw. The same childish feet, tilted, dangling. Dewey had imagined that with the deaths of Smith and Hickok, he would experience a sense of climax, release, of a design justly completed. Instead, he discovered himself recalling an incident of almost a year ago, a casual encounter in Valley View Cemetery, which, in retrospect, had somehow for him more or less ended the Clutter case. The pioneers who founded Garden City were necessarily a Spartan people, but when the time came to establish a formal cemetery, they were determined, despite arid soil and the troubles of transporting water, to create a rich contrast to the dusty streets, the austere plains. The result, which they named Valley View, is situated above the town on a plateau of modest altitude. Seen today, it is a dark island lapped by the undulating surf of surrounding wheat fields. A good refuge from a hot day, for there are many cool paths unbrokenly shaded by trees planted generations ago. One afternoon, the previous May, a month when the fields blaze with the green-gold fire of half-grown wheat, Dewey had spent several hours at Valley View weeding his father's grave, an obligation he had too long neglected. Dewey was 51, 4 years older than when he had supervised the Clutter investigation. But he was still lean and agile, and still the KBI's principal agent in western Kansas. Only a week earlier, he had caught a pair of cattle rustlers. The dream of settling on his farm had not come true, for his wife's fear of living in that sort of isolation had never lessened. Instead, the Deweys had built a new house in town. They were proud of it, and proud, too, of both their sons, who were deep-voiced now and as tall as their father. The older boy was headed for college in the autumn. When he had finished weeding, Dewey strolled along the quiet paths. He stopped at a tombstone marked with a recently carved name, Tate. Judge Tate had died of pneumonia the past November. Wreaths, brown roses, and rain-faded ribbons still lay upon the raw earth. Close by, fresher petals spilled across a newer mound. The grave of Bonnie Jean Ishida, the Ishida's elder daughter, who while visiting Garden City had been killed in a car collision. Deaths, births, marriages. Why, just the other day he'd heard that Nancy Clutter's boyfriend, young Bobby Rupp, had gone and got married. The graves of the Clutter family, four graves gathered under a single gray stone, lie in a far corner of the cemetery. Beyond the trees, out in the sun, almost at the wheat field's bright edge. As Dewey approached them, he saw that another visitor was already there. A willowy girl with white-gloved hands, a smooth cap of dark honey hair, and long, elegant legs. She smiled at him, and he wondered who she was. "Have you forgotten me, Mr. Dewey?" "Susan Kidwell." He laughed. She joined him. "Sue Kidwell. I'll be darned." He hadn't seen her since the trial. She had been a child then. "How are you? How's your mother?"
"Fine, thank you. She's still teaching music at the Holcomb School."
"Haven't been that way lately. Any changes?"
Oh, there's some talk about paving the streets. But you know Holcomb. Actually, I don't spend much time there. This is my junior year at KU, she said, meaning the University of Kansas. I'm just home for a few days.
That's wonderful, Sue. What are you studying?
Everything.
Art, mostly.
I love it. I'm really happy.
She glanced across the prairie.
Nancy and I planned to go to college together. We were going to be roommates. I think about it sometimes. Suddenly, when I'm very happy, I think of all the plans we made.
Dewey looked at the gray stone inscribed with four names and the date of their death, November 15th, 1959. Do you come here often?
Once in a while. Gosh, the sun's strong.
She covered her eyes with tinted glasses.
Remember Bobby Rupp? He married a beautiful girl.
So I heard.
Colleen Whitehurst. She's really beautiful. And very nice, too.
Good for Bobby. And to tease her, Dewey added, But how about you? You must have a lot of beaus.
Well, nothing serious. But that reminds me, do you have the time?
Oh, she cried when he told her it was past four.
I've got to run. But it was nice to have seen you, Mr. Dewey.
And nice to have seen you, Sue. Good luck, he called after her as she disappeared down the path. A pretty girl in a hurry, her smooth hair swinging, shining. Just such a young woman as Nancy might have been. Then, starting home, he walked toward the trees and under them, leaving behind him the big sky, the whisper of wind voices in the wind-bent wheat. The end. This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of In Cold Blood, A True Account of a Multiple Murder and Its Consequences by Truman Capote. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and directed by Tony Huds. Text copyright 1965 by Truman Capote. Copyright renewed 1993 by Alan U. Schwartz. Production copyright 2006, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.